Good morning. That's enough being friendly. It's working? Yeah, we're working. All right. And as Matthew mentioned, this is the second week in our series, Inside Out and Upside Down, looking at the Sermon on the Mount. So that's three chapters in the Gospel of Matthew. We're looking at it from Matthew that summarize Jesus' teaching about the kingdom of heaven, about how to live in a way that aligns with God's will. So last week, if you were here, you will know we looked at the context about how this teaching is presented in Matthew's Gospel in as part of a sequence. So Jesus is baptized, he has this epiphany, he has this revelation of God's love for him, of God's pleasure in him as God's son. And then he immediately goes into the wilderness on his own and reflects and has this time alone to think, to do a lot of thinking. And the very next thing after he comes out of the wilderness in Matthew's Gospel is this Sermon on the Mount. And so we're trying to take that same context as we look at this passage. We are approaching this from a position of recognizing that we are loved by God. We are children of God, and God delights in us. God is pleased with us. And we are also approaching it in a reflective manner. So, you know, I think sometimes the Sermon on the Mount is a lot about do this and do that, and this is how you should act. But of course, there's a whole lot of stuff inside that dictates how we act. So we're looking from the inside out. We want to look at those thought processes and our motives and what drives our behavior, rather than just looking at our external behavior. And so we have a focus throughout this series on stillness, and you'll see that particularly in the materials. If you haven't picked those up, feel free to pick up a copy out in the commons. You can also download it online or look at it online. And there are some practices for each of the weeks to take some time to be still, to center ourselves. In our crazy world, often we don't have a chance for that. So, you know, just take that time for yourself to be still and to reflect on some of the themes that we're looking at through this series. So last week also, we looked at what's the end goal of all this? What's this all leading us to? And that is to lead a healthy, fruit-bearing life, to lead a good, wholesome life. You may remember we looked at those four metaphors. Salt and light, Jesus talks about us being salt and light. So what do we taste like to people? What impression do people come away with when they interact with us? We looked at good and bad fruit. We looked at leading a life of integrity, a congruent life, if you like, as Eugene Peterson called it. How we behave, how we act, the way we speak, does that reflect who we are on the inside? Does that reflect our values? Does that reflect who we want to be? And we looked at how this is actually really hard work, right? I mean, it's easy in a way to do the right things, or it can be easy, but to have those right, to be right on the inside is really hard work. It's like a narrow gate or a narrow path. It's like building on rock. It's like chiseling down. It can be hard. So this week we're going to look at the first part of the Sermon on the Mount, which is a poem called the Beatitudes. The word beatitude is from the Latin for blessed, because this poem is all about being blessed. So we're going to go ahead and read that, and actually Kevin's going to come and read it for us.
Now, when Jesus saw the crowd, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me? Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you.
So the author of Matthew's Gospel has written this in the form of a poem. We assume it was a he. We don't know exactly who wrote the Gospel, but given the culture, it's likely it was a he. He doesn't indent the lines the way we did there to show that it's a poem. That's our convention. And it doesn't rhyme in Greek, just so you know. But it is still recognizable as being poetic form. There are two thematically distinct stanzas, each with 36 words. There's alliteration, there's assonance, and so on. It's clearly written in poetic form. And I think that's important because the way we read poetry is different to the way we read other kinds of texts. It's clear, I think, that this is not meant to be some kind of an exhaustive list of everyone who's blessed by God, and they just all happen to start with P in the first verse. You know, I mean, clearly not. These have been selected, shaped, put together to make a poem, I think a very beautiful poem. But poems contain ambiguity. It's generally hard to say this is the one and only definitive meaning of a poem. There are different ways of interpreting it, as compared to, say, a rule book, where you want everything to be very explicit, there's one way of understanding, and that's the way it is. This is not a rule book, this is a poem. And so this lovely poem, only 72 words long in the Greek, has had so many different books written about it. I have one at home about the Beatitudes called What Jesus Meant. And I love that title. It makes me laugh every time because it's such an arrogant title, right? It's like 150 pages. This is what Jesus meant. And there are, of course, hundreds, if not thousands, of articles and books about this poem that are all really saying, this is what Jesus meant. No, this is what Jesus meant. Lots of different conflicting interpretations of what this is all about. So obviously this morning, I'll tell you what Jesus really meant. I won't. Just joking. But I do think that we should keep this in mind, that it is a poem, that the writer's captured Jesus' teaching in a poem. These are not the verbatim words of Jesus, right? There was not a stenographer sat on the mountainside that day. So it behooves us, I think, to have a dose of humility as we approach this, and an openness, as well as an appreciation for the beauty of the poem as a whole, rather than kind of rushing in and starting to dissect it as though it's some kind of a legal document where you can pass all the words. I don't think it's meant to be read in that way. And that, I guess, is probably also an excuse for why my message might go all over the place this morning. I'm a very logical thinker, and I kind of like my points to lead one from another. I don't think you can do that with a poem. I think it's a creative expression rather than a logically progressing argument. So anyway, that's my excuse. So this is a poem about being blessed. 8 times in the poem, and then that 9th time in that the bit after, the bit that's not in poetic form, that seems kind of like a coda or an explanation of the poem, we see this word blessed. I think blessed is a bit of a funny word. It's not one that we use all that much. We use it when someone sneezes, which is a real historic kind of carryover. A few years ago, there was a really cheesy hashtag, I don't know if there still is, of hashtag blessed. If you were a fan of Parks and Recreation, you might remember this one, 4 green lights in a row, blessed. So, you know, that went on for a while. Otherwise, I think it's a bit of a religious word. You know, we might say a blessing, maybe before a meal. Or we might say that God has blessed us with something. So, you know, as a way of expressing gratitude. So we might say we're blessed with a nice home or a good family or a nice job or whatever. Or with 4 green lights in a row, you know. But in the Beatitudes, blessing, being blessed is a little bit different to that. So let's look at this word. The Sermon on the Mount was written down in Greek. Jesus spoke Aramaic, but the Christian scriptures are written almost exclusively in Greek. And the English word blessed is a translation of the Greek word, which I've highlighted red here, makari, which is a plural for makarios. Now, makarios is a hard word to translate because, like a lot of words, it's taken on different meanings over time and in different contexts. So in ancient Greek, long before Jesus' time, the word was only used of the Greek gods. They live in, they live on Mount Olympus in the state of bliss and contentment. That's what it was to be blessed. And then over time, it became applied to the dead. They live on a different plane to the rest of us. They're beyond the kind of day-to-day struggles that we have. So, if you were dead, you were blessed, or you could be blessed if you were dead. And then later still, it was applied to the wealthy, because they kind of seem to live above day-to-day problems too. So they were the blessed. You had to be rich to be blessed. And then this word, Makarios, was used in the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, written in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE. And in that context, being blessed took on more of a theological connotation. It meant more about, a religious context. So there it meant being blessed as meant being rewarded by God for following the Torah, for living in God's way, for following the law and the religious practices, the law given through Moses. And generally that reward was material. It meant more land, it meant abundant harvests, more servants, more kids, more livestock, and also good health. And good standing in the community meant that you were respected, you were honored in the community because you followed the law. And these were the blessed people. These were the ones that you knew God was pleased with, God approved of, God favored because they were wealthy and healthy and happy and in good standing in the community. So I want you to imagine for a moment that you live in the first century Jewish culture and you're a respectable, good person. You're a good community member, you try and help out where you can, you study the scriptures daily, you work hard, you put some money aside, you're doing well, and you hear about Jesus. He's reputedly a good man, a holy man, he brings some fresh insights on the Torah, and so you decide you'll take your family and you'll go up and, you could learn a thing or two, and you'll go up and listen to what he has to say. So you go up on that mountain that day, and the first words Jesus says are, "Favored by God are, literally, the ones whose spirit is empty and crouching like a beggar." Whoa, excuse me, kind of rude. You probably wouldn't think, well, I have a spirit that's empty and crouching like a beggar. And what's he saying? Does that mean that I'm not blessed? Seems a bit off. Or the next one that he says, "Favored by God are, literally, the ones who display their grief." So these are not the ones who mourn privately but have the decency to, keep up appearances in public. These are the ones who let it all hang out. What do we say? Favored are those who bring everybody down, who lament and wail. Really? Are we really to think that they're the ones who are favored by God? And Jesus goes on, "Favored by God are the gentle, the meek ones, the ones who get passed over. Favored by God are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness and justice and keep hungering and don't seem to get what they're looking for. They seem to get ignored." These don't sound like the successful, influential pillars of society that we consider blessed. To Jesus' first century Jewish audience, these words were countercultural and counterintuitive. In fact, they were kind of oxymoronic. How can you say blessed are the poor in spirit? If they were blessed, they'd be rich in spirit. They're rich in every way. That's kind of what it means to be blessed. How can you say blessed are those who mourn? The blessed live lives of comfort and joy and not mourning. The blessed aren't meek and oppressed. They're honored and respected leaders. So this is nonsensical. It's kind of all upside down. But now I want you to imagine that you're poor, dirt poor, that you're constantly wondering where your next meal is going to come from. Imagine you're oppressed, you've been cheated, you can't get justice, you feel voiceless, ignored, your heart aches. Imagine having spent your whole life feeling that God didn't think very much of you, that you were poor and oppressed because you were not favored, you weren't valued, you weren't accepted, you weren't worthy, you really didn't contribute much to the community. Then imagine the power of these words of Jesus. God favors those who are poor in spirit, all those who are unsure and scared and doubting and broken, those who feel they've got nothing to offer. The kingdom of heaven is theirs. God accepts and honors those who mourn, those who are overwhelmed with a sense of loss, who feel empty inside, who have to hold it all together when they want to fall apart, they will be comforted. God blesses those who are meek, all those who are marginalized, unnoticed, and unrepresented. They will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger for justice and for righteousness, those who are oppressed and exploited. They will be satisfied. I think those words would still have been shocking, but in a really good way, right? If you were poor, this would be good news. Poor and weak and marginalized as you might be, you are seen by God. You are loved and valued by God, favored by God. Despite appearances, despite cultural assumptions, you are blessed. I think this would be really good news. And though it would be surprising, and it would be kind of the antithesis of what most people in the community kind of assumed, it's actually not totally shocking, because there has always been in Jewish thought, there has been this belief communicated particularly by the prophets that one day when God sends the Messiah, the promised one, to bring in the kingdom of God, when people finally live in line with God's will and God's rule of the way life should be lived, then there will be a reversal of fortunes. Status and hierarchies will all get turned over. Privilege, will be reversed. And the rulers, the rich and the powerful, they will be brought low. And the humble and the poor will be lifted up. And in fact, that's something that the writer of Luke's gospel, as opposed to Matthew's gospel, really brings out and is explicit about. So in Luke's gospel, the Beatitudes are included in chapter 6. And prior to that, we have two very distinct examples of Luke referencing the Hebrew prophets about this great reversal. In Luke 1, we have Mary's song of praise, the so-called Magnificat. You might remember we looked at that just before Christmas. It's a song praising God for remembering that ancient promise to send a Messiah, a Savior. And the song echoes words from 1 Samuel chapter 2. And it reads, God has brought down the rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. God has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty. And then a second time, Luke references this upsetting of the hierarchies. In chapter 4, Jesus, now as an adult, returns to his hometown of Nazareth and goes into the synagogue and reads from the prophet Isaiah. Reads this, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." So Luke is pointing out, even before we get to the Beatitudes, that Jesus, God's anointed, God's long-promised Messiah, will bring good news to the poor, will fill the hungry, will set the oppressed free, will proclaim God's favor. And these references to the prophets, I think, do two things. First, they root the Beatitudes in the Jewish scriptures, highlighting the point that Jesus didn't come to kind of throw out the law, throw out the Torah, get rid of the prophets, get rid of what Moses taught and the other prophets. Quite the reverse. Jesus came to fulfill these things. Jesus wasn't setting up some new system, some new religion, but was revealing the true extent, this true meaning of the law and the prophets. And second, it brings out the fact that Jesus is not just describing who is blessed, he's also making it so. And that's another source of ambiguity that we see in this poem. In Jewish culture, you could describe someone as blessed, you could, state the fact that they are blessed, or if you had the authority, you could actually bless someone, you could make it so. We don't really have that in our culture, so it seems a bit of a foreign concept. But maybe something that we can imagine that's a little bit like it is, imagine if there was a king or a queen who could say, from this day forth, you will be the lord of wherever, Spencerville, or duke of whatever, Burtonsville. And it's so simply because they say so. Someone's status has changed because the person speaking has got the authority to do that. And in Jewish culture, a blessing is a change in status. It's moving from being unblessed to being blessed, from being not favored to being favored. And it was a very personal thing. A father could bless his children, or he could curse his children. And there was power in it. It was considered to actually achieve something, to do something. A blessed son, given that it was a patriarchal society, a blessed son inherited the family estate. A blessed son carried the name of the father, could act in the father's name, had the authority of the father, could assume his father's place in the community. So to bless someone, if you had the authority to do so, was to bestow on them something of yourself. In fact, one commentator described it this way, that to bless in Jewish culture was to irreversibly convey to someone something of the power and vitality of who you are, as well as something of the life-giving power of God, in whose name the blessing is given. So here Jesus seems not just to be describing who is blessed, blessed are the poor in spirit, the mourning, the meek, those who hunger for righteousness, and so on, but as God's anointed, he's actually bestowing blessing on them. He's bringing that blessing into being. He's granting them God's favor. He is announcing this great reversal that we've seen in the prophets and that's throughout the prophets, this great reversal of the kingdom of heaven, where those who are once considered out are actually in. Those who are considered least are actually the first, the greatest. So as we said, this is a poem, and there are lots of different ways of interpreting a poem. And one way is to say this is shocking, this is almost nonsensical, it's turning everything on its head. Another way, and quite a common way of reading this poem, is to view all the people that Jesus describes as blessed as virtuous, because God blesses the virtuous. So that would make sense. And the second stanza certainly reads that way. There we have, blessed are the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, those who are persecuted for righteousness. So those seem to be virtuous ways of living. But if the first stanza is also describing the virtuous, then rather than thinking of the poor in spirit as having an empty, crouched down, beggarly spirit, as being someone who's got nothing to offer, someone totally needy, instead maybe we can think of the poor in spirit as being humble people, people who don't have this big inflated sense of ego, people that therefore God can use and are open to living in God's way. Or maybe it refers to someone who has chosen to live a simple life, a materially poor life, someone who's rejected commercialism, someone who refuses to be judged or to judge others according to wealth and status. And such people would, I think, in general, live or have a better chance of living fulfilled and happy lives, a kingdom of heaven life, a blessed life. And I think we see some of those principles elsewhere in the gospel. So I think that is a valid way of interpreting this poem. And we can look at the next one in the same way, through that same lens. Blessed are those who mourn. That could mean people who are depressed and lamenting, but it could also be people who have empathy, people who share in the pain of others, people who grieve over all that's wrong and broken in our world. The meek, too, who will inherit the earth. Maybe those are the people who quietly persevere, those who are gentle and put others' needs ahead of their own, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness and justice, whether for themselves or for other people. They reflect the priorities of the kingdom of heaven. Later in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, seek first God's kingdom and God's righteousness. And then obviously with the second verse, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, those who are persecuted for righteousness, they're all living in a way that reflects the kingdom of heaven. And in fact, we can see that taken from this perspective, Jesus actually embodies all of these characteristics. He doesn't just pronounce them blessed, he actually models them in his own life. In chapter 11 of Matthew's gospel, we read that Jesus says this, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. And that word that there is translated gentle is the same word that in the Beatitudes is translated meek. So Jesus has these characteristics. Jesus embodies these attributes. And actually, perhaps only someone who models these things can declare them blessed. Only someone who knows what it is to be poor and hungry, knows what it is to mourn, someone who has been persecuted for righteousness can say that this is blessed. I think we'd be very skeptical of someone who cynical even, actually, of someone who lives a comfortable, rich life, carefree, they have privilege, and them saying, blessed are the poor and the meek and the mourning. Jesus knew what he was talking about because he experienced these things. He lived this poor in spirit life. He pronounced it blessed, favored by God. We live in a post-Christian culture, and so we're probably quite familiar with these words. I think it's very unlikely that we're shocked by them, by the Beatitudes. We've probably heard them many times before, and even if we're not really, we don't remember reading them all that much. I think they're part of our cultural identity, our cultural heritage. I think these are things that sound like, yeah, we've probably heard that before. And as followers of Jesus, we probably all pay lip service to these things. But do we really believe them? Do we really think they work? Do we really think, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven? Or if we're honest, do we think, well, blessed are the confident, for they've got the courage to take what they want? Do we really believe, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted? Or do we actually think, well, blessed are those who don't get too involved, because they'll have comfortable lives? Do we think blessed are the meek, for they'll inherit the earth? Or blessed are those who stand up for themselves, for they won't get pushed around? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness and for justice, for they'll be filled? Or blessed are those who don't ruffle too many feathers, they'll get along with everybody? Blessed are the merciful, for they'll be shown mercy? Or blessed are those who give as good as they get, because then they won't get taken advantage of? Do we think blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God? Or blessed are those who know how to work the system? For people like that, well, they're kind of smart. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be children of God. Or blessed are those who know how to win an argument so that they get the last word. Is it really blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven? Or blessed are the popular, for they've got all the kingdoms. They've got everything. Do we really embody the Beatitudes like Jesus did? Or do we think, well, they're really great concepts, but honestly, they don't really work in the kind of life I have to live, in the world that I'm in, my society. They don't really get you where you need to go. They don't really work. And honestly, they didn't really work for Jesus, right? I mean, Jesus was betrayed and rejected, tortured, and ultimately executed. These attributes are clearly not a recipe for an easy, enjoyable life. And yet Jesus calls them blessed. Why? Well, I think there are two reasons. First, I think these attributes in some way contain within them their own reward. Those who are poor in spirit, who are humble, who live simple lives, will enjoy a freedom and a joy that egotistical, arrogant people, people who are always out to get more, will never have. Materialism and status seeking are unlikely to lead to fulfilled and contented lives. This is something we talk about a lot here at Cedar Ridge. I think we know that. We end up comparing ourselves to others. We're never content. And Jesus says elsewhere that it's hard for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's not impossible. Nothing's impossible with God, but it's hard. Presumably it's harder than it is for the poor in spirit. And those who mourn are generally those who care. We grieve the loss of others because we love them. We grieve the brokenness in the world because we care about people. We long for them to live good and healthy and happy lives. Sorrow can also produce character. It can teach us empathy and compassion. So, maybe this mourning is a sign that we really live life fully, that we really love and we really get engaged and we really care. Meekness or gentleness can be a very beautiful characteristic, one that enables us to form deep, meaningful relationships, and so on. So I think we can read all of these Beatitudes in some way as carrying their own reward. Living this way is a good way to live. It does lead to a healthy life and a blessed life. Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Is. This is the present tense. The kingdom of heaven is theirs now. These characteristics do carry that here and now kind of aspect. But I think if we take this view, we have to be careful that we don't romanticize these attributes. I'm sure there were many people in the crowd that day who were listening to Jesus who knew what poverty was, who knew what it was to be in mourning, to be oppressed and to not get justice. And I really doubt that they would be sat there thinking, oh yes, I am so happy that I'm poor and grieving and marginalized and I can't get justice because I know it's making me a better person. These things can do that, but they don't necessarily do that. Those who mourn may not be comforted, and they don't necessarily learn empathy. Actually, it can lead to bitterness. The meek may be cruelly exploited. Those who long for justice may not get it, not in this lifetime. And this leads to the second reason why I think we should live like this, which is that our current situation is not the end of the story. There is the present tense in the Beatitudes. Jesus is describing those who are truly blessed, but there's also the future tense. It says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Jesus is not just describing the blessed, he's also promising future blessing. Those who mourn now will not always mourn. One day they will be comforted. The meek will not always be pushed aside. One day they will inherit the earth. Those who long for righteousness and justice will one day be satisfied. Our current reality is not the end of the story. The kingdom of heaven is at hand, but it's still small and growing quietly. It's like a mustard seed in the ground, Jesus says elsewhere, or it's like yeast in bread dough. We're still praying, may God's kingdom come. It is not fully here yet. And so there's also this sense in which the Beatitudes are the way we should live, whether it works or whether it doesn't, whether it gives us what we're looking for in life or whether it doesn't. Because this is how life is meant to be lived. Mother Teresa wrote a poem that's quite well known, and it begins like this. People are often unreasonable, irrational, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. The good you do today will often be forgotten. Do good anyway. And so it continues. Do it anyway, because the kingdom of heaven, life in conformity with God's will, is coming and will one day fill the earth. Jesus begins the Sermon on the Mount with emphatic blessing. 9 times he says, blessed, you are blessed, you are blessed, you are blessed. Life is often tough and unfair and sad, but you are blessed. God is with you. God favors you. Whether you feel like God does or not. God is with even the hurting and the poor, especially with the hurting and the poor. To be blessed is to be filled with a spirit of hope and encouragement and reassurance, even when life is hard, because this is not the end of the story. J.R.R. Tolkien, of course, the famous writer of the Lord of the Ring books, invented this word, I love this word, eucatastrophe. Literally in the Greek, it's good destruction. And he invented this word for the place where a story suddenly turns and good is vindicated. In fact, we have a quote from his writings. I coined the term eucatastrophe, the sudden happy turn in a story which pierces you with a joy that brings tears, because it's a sudden glimpse of truth. Your whole nature chained to material cause and effect, the chain of death, feels a sudden relief as if a major limb out of joint had suddenly snapped back. It perceives that this is indeed how things really do work in the great world for which nature is made. This joy is a sudden and miraculous grace. It denies, in the face of much evidence, if you will, universal defeat, final defeat, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief. Tolkien said that the greatest eucatastrophe was the resurrection of Jesus, that greatest of all reversals, that swallowing up of death in life, of hope being swallowed up by love, of despair being swallowed up by hope. And I think there is something eucatastrophic about the Beatitudes. This wonderful declaration that despite what we might think, what circumstances might suggest, what our culture might promote, the poor in spirit are indeed favored by God, and the kingdom of heaven is theirs. I think this poem at the beginning of Matthew's gospel can be understood in a whole number of different ways, all of which I think bring out important different aspects and important truths. But I want to circle back to this idea that this was shocking to the non-poor, to the respectable, to the good people who would have heard this. This was even, I think, probably a little offensive. Because I think we're quick to say, well, I'm poor in spirit and I'm all those things. But actually, we're probably all of, I would say I am probably one of the respectable people, one of the people who likes to think that I'm a pretty good person. And I don't want us to lose that sense of shock value that I think was very evident there in the midst of all these other interpretations. I think it's shocking because Jesus says that the people who society sees as losers, and those were the categories in that culture of the people who are kind of losers, they seem to have nothing to offer. The people who don't even seem to be trying, really, the undeserving poor, they are loved and accepted and favored by God. And that doesn't seem very fair. Because some of us are trying. Some of us are keeping the rules. Some of us are doing our best, and we should be the blessed ones. If I was writing Matthew's gospel, I think I would put the Beatitudes at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. So that way Jesus could say, you know, do this, do that, you know, love your enemy, go the extra mile, pray, trust God, give to the poor, all those kind of things. And then if you do, you'll be blessed. You'll be favored by God. That would be fair. That would make more sense to me. Keep the rules and God will be pleased with you. But Jesus doesn't do that. Before giving any instructions at all, Jesus declares these losers to be blessed. And not, it seems, because of anything that they've done. And the theological term for this, of course, this kind of religious word, is grace. The unmerited, unearned favor of God. In Matthew chapter 20, Jesus tells a story, you might remember it, of a landowner who goes to the marketplace to hire workers. He goes there early in the morning, and he hires some people to work all day on his vineyard. And then, you know, it gets a little later, he goes back out and hires some more workers. And he tells them, you know, I'll pay you what's right. And they agree. He goes out mid-morning, does the same at noon, at 3 o'clock, and at 5 o'clock. And at the end of the day, all the workers come to get paid, and they all get paid one day's wage, including those who only work for 1 hour. They were hired at 5 o'clock. It's a terrible story. I don't like that story. It is not fair, right? Grace is great when you're the ones receiving it. When you're the one that gets hired at 5 o'clock, this is a great story. When we've totally screwed up, when we know we've failed, when we feel like a real loser, it is wonderful to hear that we are loved and accepted and favored. But when other people screw up, when other people fail us and hurt us or seem to act in a way that is just not acceptable, then grace is offensive. It's unfair. When we're doing well, when we feel that we've accomplished something, when we've tried to please God, then too, grace is kind of offensive. It's unfair. For the duration of Lent, we're going to be looking at the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus gives a whole load of instruction. But I think the writer of Matthew's gospel seems to want it to make it very clear, right up front, following these instructions will not help you get or keep God's favor. Nothing you do will make you more loved, more favored, more accepted, more blessed. Blessing is already freely given. You can't earn it. We can't earn it. So the motivation to follow the way of living that Jesus will go on to describe for the rest of the sermon is not because if we do that, then we will be loved and favored, but because we know already that we are loved and favored. Knowing that we are blessed gives us the freedom and the inspiration to live our lives in accordance with the way of Jesus. So if we try and wrap up some of these kind of a little bit disparate thoughts, I think we can summarize by saying, one, you are blessed, whether you feel it this morning or you don't feel it. You are loved and accepted and favored by God, and not because of anything you've done. And at the same time, not in spite of what you've done. You are loved because God is love. Sometimes we have different analogies. Some work for some people, others work for others. But I think a beautiful analogy is God being like sun streaming through a window. You just sit in that light and that warmth. You can feel yourself absorbing it. It surrounds you, and it's got nothing to do with you. It's everything to do with the sun. I think we can think of it in that way. You are blessed. We are all blessed. follows from that, right? So that doesn't just apply to me, that implies to the people around me. It's all about God as loved. We are all loved and accepted. It's got nothing to do with performance. And so we can bless others. Knowing that we are all loved, all accepted, frees us from needing to judge ourselves and judge others, from figuring out and trying to see how do people measure up and are they worthy of loving. It allows us to accept ourselves and accept others. Knowing we're already blessed, we don't need to perform. We can admit to ourselves where we are poor in spirit, where we're mourning, where we long for righteousness and know we don't have it. We can be aware of and we can have compassion on our anxieties and our pains and our struggles, and we can do that in the stillness. And we can also have that attitude towards others, to people that we interact with. We can live from a place of love and acceptance because we are loved and accepted. We're going to celebrate communion in a few moments, and so the band can come back up if you would like. But and communion, however we take it, even in these, taking it in a different form so that we're aware of the situation, it is still a wonderful physical ritual that reminds us that we are all loved. We all come here. We all take of this because we're all loved. We're all accepted. Absolutely everybody here is warmly welcome to join in communion, whether you feel close to God, whether you wonder if there is a God, however good or badly you feel right now, however much you feel you measure up or you don't, you are loved and you are accepted and you are welcome. The love of God demonstrated through Jesus is absolutely for you. But before we take communion, we're going to spend a few moments in stillness. I want us to sit comfortably and to breathe deeply and to rest in God's presence. So just take a moment to still yourselves, to still your thoughts. Just take some deep breaths. To recognize that God is here. Love is here. That it surrounds each one of us. Let's listen again to those words of blessing. Blessed are you who are poor in spirit, unsure, scared, doubting, broken. You who feel you have nothing to offer, you belong in God's kingdom. Blessed are you who grieve, who are overwhelmed with a sense of loss, who feel empty inside, who have to hold it all together when you want to fall apart. God sees and cares and will comfort you. Blessed are you who are marginalized, who feel slow and awkward. You quiet ones who get passed over, go unnoticed and underrepresented. All that is good will be yours. Blessed are you who long for justice, you who are oppressed and all who stand beside you. You who desperately need more of God in your life, you will receive the desire of your heart. Blessed are you who forgive even when it hurts. You who choose to love in the face of hostility, who overlook slights and believe the best of others. God will do the same for you. Blessed are you who would rather lose than cheat, who rejoice in the success of others, you who have no hidden agenda, who work without expectation of reward. God will be very present to you. Blessed are you who defend the weak and oppose aggression. You mediators and trusted friends, you who don't need to be right, others will see God in you. Blessed are you who suffer for doing the right thing, who stay true when the going is hard, who are faithful to the end. The kingdom of heaven is yours. Blessed are you. You are loved. You are accepted. You are favored. Amen.